Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Resource Committee meeting to order at 1:03 p.m. on today is Wednesday, February the 10th, 2015. And our members present are Representative Johnson, Representative Josephson, Representative Seaton, Representative Olson, our Vice Chair, Representative Hawker. I am co-chair Representative Tallarico, and today co-chair Representative Nagyok is excused. So I'd like the record to reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. I'd also like to recognize the staff we have today. Our recording secretary is Julie Kohler, and our teleconference expert is Matt Kern. Thank you very much for being here today. Our committee aide, Gary Zepp. Gary's here in the room from Representative Nagyok's office, and my committee aide is Julie Morris. Julie's right up here off to my left. I'd like to ask everyone to please silence your cell phones for the meeting. And today we are going to continue presentation from, I do believe, Commissioner Hoffbeck and Director Alper. So if you'd please like to come forward, we'll have you identify yourselves for the record. We also have online for questions, if anyone has those, and a reference that I know the Commissioner and Director Alper are familiar with, Paul Decker and Ed King, both from the Division of Oil and Gas, Lenny Dees with the Department of Revenue Tax Division, and Corey Feige as well with Division of Oil and Gas. So I believe we can pick up where we left off at our last presentation, but any opening statements, and please identify yourselves. Thank you.
Chairman Tallarico, members of the committee for the board, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner Revenue. And I did want to make a statement. Over the last week, it became readily apparent that in our discussions on the ICER study and what would be provided I'd left an impression on what they would be providing us that was simply not consistent with what the report that they intend to deliver. And so I just wanted to clarify that on the record. We are expecting an executive summary from ICER by tomorrow and a draft report by Monday. And Gunnar Knapp has indicated he is more than willing to come and testify before the committee on the report. But the report is much more high level than I think what the expectation was in that, not expectation that we had with Gunnar, but the expectation that I left the board, left the committee. And his really is looking at the governor's fiscal plan or the fiscal plan in general and the relative impacts of the decisions that would be made on taxes versus cuts in employees versus cuts in capital versus using portions of the earnings versus reducing the dividend, kind of the relative economic impacts that each of those have on the state's economy. But it does not drill down into the competitiveness of oil and gas based on which cuts or which of the credits remain and which ones don't.
Thank you, Commissioner.
And on this point,
Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I do appreciate the clarification on the ICER report because, again, I did come prepared today as I had the proposal they'd put forward that was going to work. And I'd just like to a couple points of clarity because you said that it was going to be a very high level. The impact analysis that they have said they were going to provide you on all these alternatives were like impacts on the number of jobs and total incomes by the sector and industry and region, distributional impacts, impacts on incomes of Alaskans by income group, including, you know, regions, et cetera, demographics, as well as, you know, and then a long list of really three major type of impact analyses. So, you know, certainly when I read this, I thought, okay, you had a really good thing coming here that was going to address the concerns that I had as a committee member, and that is, what are the economic impacts of the legislation you're proposing on state's competitiveness, productivity, jobs, the economy, you know, literally the lives of the people will be affected by a change we make. So if ICER is not going to be doing this, who will be doing this for you?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, at some level they are going to do this, but it won't be drilled down to the point of saying that if this credit, specific credit is reduced or eliminated, you know, what the competitiveness, what kind of competitive imbalance that may create for a company and whether they'll invest and what that has in long-term impacts on production in the future. That kind of depth won't be there. It'll be more, I think, an issue of the specific tax may affect a different region differently. In general, a tax, $100 million in new taxes affects the economy in this way. I think it's going to be more at that level. So it's not going to be quite the depth that that you were speaking of.
Follow up, Rev. Hawker?
Well, it begs, Mike, we seem to be back relying upon the ICER study that you just said wasn't going to do this. Will they be examining the aggregate effects and giving an impact analysis of the effects of House Bill 247?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, only to the extent of a general statement on taxes, I believe, and that, you know, $100 million in taxes would have this kind of effect generally on the economy, but it will not drill down into the details of this bill on a specific credit and what the impact would be. It's going to be more of an overview of just general tax policy.
Last question.
Representative Hawker.
Last question. Do you think that is an adequate economic analysis for us as legislators to have in our possession in order to make a valid judgment on your bill?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker. I don't believe the ICER report is going to be the sufficient for you to make the decision based on that particular report. I do want to state that, I mean, we didn't make the decisions in a vacuum. We did meet over 30 times with the various industry players and those that were lobbying against the credits. We do have the raw data that underlies the credits on where they've been spent and what the results of those expenditures have been. We had good data in putting this bill together. Unfortunately, most of it's in a format that we can't readily share with the committee. We're hoping that the testimony and the industry participants testify that some of that information will be able to come out at that point in time.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was really not anticipating that ICER would be able to go down into drill into competitive advantages and disadvantages by individual oil companies or individual areas of the state and how they proceeded with their business. And I would assume that that's what we would get from them as they come forward and testify and give us that information, because they have their own internal information of what they perceive these various tax credits or the elimination of these various tax credits to be. So. And I think it may be company or sector specific, but I don't know how that we could expect a general orientation to come in and tell us what the specific impacts on those elements are going to be, because they don't have the balance sheet, they don't have the investment climate, they don't have those details that the individual oil companies have. So I would expect that we would get that from the individual companies. And hopefully it will be specific to each one of these credits, because I think the credits, impact different companies in quite different ways.
Representative Josephson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on this point and in discussion, I guess, I sort of agree with Representative Seaton, and I would add that there were seven or eight working group meetings in the fall. I attended as many of those as I could, and of course the industry attended as many as they were invited to, which was, I think, all but one. It may have been all of them. And I know that we've got Analytica. We've just renewed their contract, and at one point we had scheduled opportunities following the presentation by the administration for industry to tell us their view. I think at least they were scheduled. So I think I share Representative Seaton's point on that.
So if I could add, we've talked about the ICER report. Is there anything else on the horizon that has like a more of a modeling type structured report that you guys will be coming? Or I would assume that the industry can also provide us more of a structured type model of how this would all function. Will you guys have anything beyond that, or it pretty much just be answer?
Senator Tellerico,
For the record, I'm Ken Alper, the director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. A little later in this presentation, we talk about the economic impacts. We've done our best to parse out the different sections of the bill and their relative dollar values, and in the next section, I'll be talking about how the various sectors are impacted. The question you're asking is a lot more sort of subjective. How are those specific changes on specific sectors possibly going to influence industry decision-making? And that is a little bit beyond what we were able to do, beyond what we learned directly from talking to the participants who will be coming hopefully before your committee. And like Representative Josephson said, there are LDNA has consultants on the payroll that I'm sure will be offering their thoughts. We did not go to outside consulting services specifically to parse into the individual provisions of this bill.
May I?
Representative Hocker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's your bill. I'm kind of amazed here that it's your bill. You're asking us to pass judgment on a major change in state's tax policy. This isn't just a little tweak of tax credits. This is a major economic shift in the way we approach oil and gas taxation in this state. And you're simply offering it to us without any advocacy, any explanation, any economic, again, impact analysis of the consequences of the legislation that you are proposing. And you're saying, okay, you guys figure it out on your own. And if that's the case, that's great, because then I don't think you get the right to rebut what we do.
Through the chair, Representative Walker, I can't totally disagree with what you just said. The idea was to, let me just step back and maybe kind of walk through the process of how we got to where we are. In last year, you saw the first kind of the first indication of the impacts that the oil and gas tax credits had on the state's fiscal health. On the budget issues, not on the fiscal health, that's too broad of a term. On the budget issues, when the governor vetoed the $200 million in the credits last year, ostensibly to start the discussion on what it was that we could afford going forward in the credit program. That created the series of meetings that we had over the summer, including the meetings that Senator Gissom sponsored, to try and just really get a full understanding of the credits and who was using them and how they were being used. As we started honing in on just how big a pie did we have, how much revenue do we have, and how much of the credits would fit within that revenue pie, that became the balance what credits could we maintain, which ones we simply couldn't, how we could accommodate as many of the concerns as we possibly could on the people that we had talked to. And came up with a balance of this is what we feel is what we have available to offer for credits. We made very clear that we weren't in the discussion saying whether credits were good or bad or whether credits were good. What we were trying to do was retain as many of the credits as we possibly could under the current economic situation the state was in. So that was one of the driving factors of the discussion.
I've got Representative Herron, Representative Seaton, and then Representative Parker. Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to continue in a similar strain that Representative Hawker has, but I guess that my question, Mr. Chairman, is to Mr. Alper, is you made a statement, and I hope I heard it correctly, is you chose not to hire outside help to formulate this. My question is, why not?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, there's a number of reasons. One, we have I'm very proud of our staff inside the tax division and our friends at the Department of Natural Resources. They've got many years of experience working in this field, and we relied on their counsel and their thoughts and their analysis. A lot of what we're doing is number crunching. It doesn't necessarily require industry-specific experience. We are constrained. We don't have the money for outside consulting services that we might have had several years ago as part of the larger fiscal issues of the state of Alaska. And if you go back, Mr. Chairman, to previous major oil and gas legislation that's been before this body, although the administration has come in with a lot of outside services, really it's been quantitative services. This is how much money this change would be if you made that different, did that different, the dollar amount would change to that. No one was really speculating on what changes in behavior might be. They were modeling what the impact would be if certain behaviors A, B, or C were to occur, not saying the likelihood of any of them to occur. We could pin down with some certainty what the dollar value of these changes is. What we don't believe we have the ability to predict, which no one has the ability to predict, is how any specific player in the industry is going to react to these changes.
Mr. Chairman, just one follow-up, and then it'll be a two-parter, and then I'll be finished. I appreciate it. Was the data and the presentations and all the considerations of SB 21 by DOR or by Econ 1, was that utilized? That's part one. Part two. How involved was DNR in the developing of this proposed policy and changes in the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, the modeling from Senate Bill 21 is important in terms of it created the new model as to what the new tax structure is. The changes proposed in this bill are built on the base of Senate Bill 21, the tax rate, the per barrel credit, the new oil-specific benefits. Those are unchanged in the bill before us. So we have a tax system that came into play. None of the modeling for Senate Bill 21 predicted an additional amount of new activity or said that we would get, that wasn't part of the conversation. Likewise, we're not predicting new activity or less activity through this process. Regarding the natural resources, we were in conversation with them throughout. There are pieces of the bill, pieces of existing law that tie in more closely to their operations than others. They are very connected to, say, for example, the exploration tax credit system, which has something of a pre-approval process, which has data submission requirements. They presented multiple times in Senator Giesel's working group over the fall about how much value they perceive from that data that they get. And in response to that, we tried to find a mechanism in this legislation that even as the exploration credits begin to sunset this summer, that we continue to find a mechanism to make sure DNR can have that data for their own planning purposes, for their own marketing of Alaska's resources to the world function. So, plus, just informally, Director Feige is a close colleague. We talk about many things, and we have we spoke many times about this bill as it worked its way through the development process.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'd like to recognize that Representative Targeron just several minutes ago. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, to clarify, your presentation on the bill is the impact of the bill on the state budget and the state resources that we have or don't have, and how we can pay for those. So it's not to supersede and say what the impact on the industry is, it's or individual players, but to the impact on the budget. Am I correct in that?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the motivating factor behind having to make a change was the impact on the budget. Okay. But there was a tremendous amount of work done directly with the participants who use these credits and loan against these credits to find out what the impact on those particular individuals would be before the specific selection of the components within the bill was put together. And frankly, I think that's, at least for our purposes, is more robust than what a consultant would tell us. The part where I fall short is what Representative Hocker pointed out, that we don't have a way to present that information to you in this forum because most of that information is proprietary information. So,
Follow-up, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And I guess I do want to follow up on one thing, and that is that these credits that we're applying are an investment of state dollars. And so I'm hoping that you have net present value calculations on what the value of those investments would be over the life of the field. And, you know, I know there's some. I'm hoping that we can look at all of these in that kind of range as to, okay, the state is investing so many millions or hundreds of millions of dollars, and is that a good investment for the state or not based on the net present value of the impact that's going to occur?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the net present value of the what has already been invested or what will be invested in the future?
Projecting what, if we're making it, through the chair, projected, if we're making an investment of $100 million in, through this kind of a credit to get a certain kind of field, what is that net present value going to yield back to the state over time?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, there's two ways that we can address that. One, we certainly can look at the history of the credits that we have already paid and what the net present value impact of effect of those credits are. We've hesitated to do that because there's just certain pieces that are still unknown. I mean, some of the credits or expenditures are on fields that are still in development, so it's hard to say what the net present value of those credits are until such time as some of these fields come online and actually start to produce. As far as, you know, the go forward, we can certainly within our data see where it would be best to spend $100 million because we can kind of see the history of what's occurred up to this point in time and which fields are progressing and which ones aren't. And unfortunately, that again gets into that granularity of the data that it's difficult for us to bring forward to the committee.
If I may, through the chair, and additional response to what Representative Seaton just said, we at the Tax Division have, over the last several months, developed a life cycle field modeling structure that didn't formally exist. In many ways, we built it in honor of what Mr. Meyer did, Janik Meyer, and the LBNA consultant who developed a similar model in looking at field costs and present values during various pieces of oil legislation. So we can now say, what is a typical 50 million barrel field? What's the upfront cost? What's the upfront credits? And what do we expect to get in the back end from production taxes, royalties, and the like, given various cost and price and options? And then from that, there's a cash flow to the state and net present value. We have created this model. We have run some scenarios in response to specific requests and are prepared to share that model and its results with the committee if asked. Happy to talk about specific theoretical fields. Where it gets hard, as the commissioner said, is to talk about specific actual fields, because then you're into the internal decision making of a specific company.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I do have a question, but I mean, you just threw this back at Analytica, and respectfully, they are here to provide us independent analysis of what you're doing, not to make the case for your bill and work for you. Sincerely, we're missing something.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman, to respond to Representative Hawker. We're not expecting Analytica to do your work for us. What I just said was we tried to copy some of their methodology and some of their modeling, which we found to be very insightful and very robust. And there's no great magic to it, as long as the analyst in question has the mathematical skills, the ability to build the model. And we built the model that in many ways replicated what they have previously done for the legislature.
Thank you. With a question, I still want to get back. And we've had a lot of dialogue, and it kind of gets to the same point, but I've tried to extract a couple of comments that were made here. And am I correct that the testimony was that the motivating factor behind the construction of this bill was the impact on the budget?
To the chair, Representative Walker, the motivation to go down this path and look at credits was the budget. The motivation was not to go in and redefine oil and gas taxes and credits within the state of Alaska. It was just a recognition this was a very large expenditure that the state was carrying, that we needed to see whether there was a way that we could reduce some of that liability during tight budget times.
A few minutes ago, there was also, I think, similar testimony that the $200 million veto last year was motivated by the belief that the state just didn't have that money to spend. It was a money-motivated veto, a budget-motivated veto, it was a money-motivated and budget-focused veto alone. And I'm just wondering if, when that that veto was made, you know, that's one we've got some history on. Was the administration aware, were they expecting, and did they anticipate the profound consequences that veto had on the ability of Alaska's working industries to secure financing, to the fact that an entire consortium of international bankers withdrew money that was on the table for Alaska's industry and literally threw them into the tizzy that you talked about having to deal with all summer? Did you expect that kind of consequence when you only made a budget decision?
To the chair, Representative Hocker, we expected that it would have some collateral effects. I think the impact it had on some of the more what appeared to be stable financing situation, where a project that was a long ways along and driving towards the finish line, we probably didn't recognize that those funds would be pulled back as well. Although it took several conversations with the industry, they felt comfortable once we explained exactly the process, that the credits were still good, then they recognized that and essentially started to learn again. But we recognized it would have some impact. There's no doubt about that.
My last point on a follow-up.
Go ahead.
And that takes me right to a comment Mr. Alper made, that administration is not predicting new or lesser activity through the enactment of this bill. And it seems to me we've got evidence that a $200 million cut to the tax program had these profound ripples. As you even acknowledged yourself just now, there were consequences on industry, and in fact some that were unanticipated. But are we truly now not predicting new or lesser activity, or will there be consequences of passing this bill? And quite frankly, do you care about them? Do you want to know what they are? Do you have an idea what they are? Can you tell us what you think you are going to precipitate through this bill on the economy?
Through the chair, Representative Hocker, let me try, and I'm sure Commissioner Hoffbeck will want to say a few more things. The governor's veto was not the first step in a process, of course. The conversation began earlier in the 2015 session. The governor published an op-ed that talked about our credit spend being out of alignment with our greatly reduced production tax revenue, that suddenly we were spending more. There's a lot less elasticity in the credit spend than there is in the revenue, and the price of oil goes down. Therefore, instead of the credits being a reinvestment of some portion of a very large revenue stream, had actually grown to become larger than the revenue stream. So the idea was put on the table, we needed to do something different. The veto was not the ideal method of solving the problem, simply, but it was the only tool available to the governor at that moment. As I said in my earlier presentation, this is a two-step process. The credits are earned because of industry activity. They're claimed, they get audited, they get given a certificate. A certificate is a paper asset. Those certificates are then owned by companies, which they could either use against tax liability, if they have tax liability. They could sell them to another company who might have tax liability, or with funds available, sell them back to the state, have them repurchased through the tax credit fund. What the governor did was veto and cap the amount of money available to the tax credit fund and didn't in any way change the credits available on the street. In doing so, there's a certain uncertainty because the credits are being earned, but people are suddenly, who were expecting to get paid back, aren't going to get paid back. What we're attempting to do with this legislation is actually create a little bit more certainty. If there's fewer credits being earned, but we're going to ensure that the amount being earned is in line with the funds available, then at least when people make their decisions, they can have some certainty that they'll be able to get paid back on their credits. What makes me nervous is the possibility of there being hundreds of millions of dollars of credits certificates out there without there being funds available to buy them back. I think that causes more of a ripple effect and an uncertainty in the industry than simply trying to pay back on the program itself.
Mr. Chair. That was the governor's own budget that had those credits in it. I can take you back. Those were not legislative ads. Those were the governor's own budget that he committed to the industry, to the banking industry, to the expectations of what the word of this government was going to be, and then he reneged on it. Now, but frankly, this bill we've got in front of us, the governor also campaigned very strongly on not touching the taxes under Senate Bill 21. And we're here doing that. And I can understand the need to reassess, but again, if you're going to reassess, please, all I'm asking, and I'll let this go completely at this point, I would like to know what you think the consequences are going to be on the economy of the state of Alaska, jobs, our competitiveness in the world, an analysis of what you think is a fair share. How much government take are you expecting? How much do you think is a fair share? And I say, what I keep hearing is that we're not going to get that. We're supposed to figure it out on our own.
Through the chair, Representative Hawken, again, I think some of that information will come out when the producers testify. The decisions that were made on this bill were done not in a vacuum, in discussions with the people that use these credits. And we talked very openly about what they shared with us, what the impact of these various credit changes might be. And that largely framed some of the decisions that we made on what's still in the bill. So hopefully that information comes out in that testimony. And as Director Alper said, we can provide some information based on past practice on what the impact of the credits have been, but we're going to present it with the caveat that I think the jury's still out on some of that. And so if we come in and say that the net present value on a barrel of oil is X, and somebody brings in a much larger field, unless they make a change dramatically, we just want to make sure that we don't draw too hard a line in the sand with that information. That's one of the reasons we haven't been actively floating out that information. So, because it's early.
Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess, since you're commissioner, this is slightly off topic from oil and gas tax credits, but in 2013, we did pass a bill repealing a bunch of other tax credits and began the conversation about, whether we can afford all the credits. We did away with the film industry tax credits as a result of that. So just from your perspective, this wouldn't be the only industry credit that's under consideration right now. And, at least as recently as 3 years ago, we passed by a vote of 39-1 in the House of Representatives a bill to repeal a bunch of other credits and to start the conversation about whether we could afford some of the industry incentives that we previously had put in statute.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, that's exactly correct. And last year there was a fairly substantial bill that removed the oil and gas of the film tax credit from the statutes. So, with many of the similar conversations.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Alper, I'd love to have you begin your presentation here where you took off and see how far we can get.
It's been a week since I sat before the committee, and we're on slide number 23. Thank you, Gary, for getting us caught up. Just to quickly encapsulate what was in 1 through 22, it was really sort of the first two sections of what amounts to a four-part presentation. There was a number of slides of history and theory, how we got to where we are today, how the tax credit system developed, what's been the aggregate cost of it, that sort of thing. And then I walked through the bill thematically, looking at how the different features of the bill work. What are the changes to exploration? What are the changes to the Cook Inlet system, to the minimum tax, and so forth? What's before us in the next section of the presentation are more sector-specific analysis. How are the changes in the bill going to impact, in this first slide, the North Slope major producer? And you'll see a slide, the North Slope developer, the Cook Inlet producer, the interior explorer, that sort of thing. Following that, I'm going to talk about the aggregate fiscal impacts, the expected fiscal note of the bill, how much money we're going to see in savings, and to a small extent, increased revenue. I do want to refer back to a point that was made about government take. There's not a lot of government take in this bill. It's primarily a reduction in government outlay. The only place that government take is substantially impacted is in the sections regarding the minimum tax. Finally, there's the sectional analysis of the bill, which is going through the bill yet a third way. It's a long technical bill. It's 46 sections. And if there's time at the end of the hearing, I look forward to going through that sectional analysis describing how the bill was structured and what the individual pieces of it actually do. So having said that, Mr. Chairman, on slide 23, what happens if you're a North Slope major producer? Quite frankly, very little. If oil prices are high at the level they've been in recent history, there is no change. The 35% base tax rate of Senate Bill 21 is in place. The sliding scale per barrel credit is in place. If that oil production is eligible for the gross value reduction, that is in place. There are no changes made to those fundamental aspects of the system. If the prices drop below approximately $85 a barrel, that's the point at which the minimum tax is typically triggered. It varies from producer to producer based on that producer's individual economics. But in that world, they're currently paying a 4% minimum tax under existing law. The bill before you would increase that minimum tax to 5%. That 1% increase in the minimum tax reflects roughly $50 million in revenue in the fiscal note. If, as we're in right now, an extended period of very low prices, a second aspect of the change to the North Slope major producer would kick in, what happens then, and I referenced it in my prior presentation, once a major producer reaches an operating loss credit, once they go negative for 1 year, they can use the percentage of their operating loss, that's the operating loss credit, to offset taxes and go below the minimum tax and pay at a zero level until they've worked their way through their minimum, their operating loss credit. What the bill does is it hardens the floor, to use a colloquial term we use internally. It makes it so that these credits can't be used to reduce the payments below the minimum tax. The minimum tax would need to be paid at the 4%, or if that provision survives 5% level, the credits remain alive. The producer in question would carry those credits forward to a subsequent calendar year when hopefully prices have recovered sufficiently that they'll have tax liability and they can use their operating loss to offset their tax liability in a future year. So that's, in a nutshell, what the North Slope major producer experiences with House Bill 247.
Representative Hocker, any question? And the testimony is important, and I want to be sure. I go back to your very prefacing comment. You identified, there are these changes here, but your preface, was not your prefacing comment that you believe there will be, as a result of the consequential fallout of this legislation, that there would be, and I believe your words were, very little impact on a major North Slope producer?
Through the chair, Representative Hocker, I believe that sentence was completed with at the prices we've seen in recent years. If they're at higher prices, there's no impact on producers, and then I highlighted what the specific impacts would be as prices are lower, both mildly lower or as we are right now in an extended period of very low prices.
And as you said, we have to go to the producers to, because we don't have impacts from you folks. But if we found out and actually could document that there were significant impacts on a major North Slope producer, using the caveat that you just put in the record, would you change your opinion on the bill?
Through the chair, Representative Hocker, there's another change in the bill that would impact large companies coming to do work in Alaska that aren't current major producers, similarly sized companies who don't currently exist here. Those companies would be prevented from being able to cash in their credits. They would have to hold them and use them against future tax liability. Right now, the major producers in Alaska are specifically prevented from being able to get cash for their credits. That's existing law for many years. They'll have to carry them forward. The hardening of the floor is tied intimately with the idea that they can't get cash for their credits, that they have to carry them forward. And we're saying, well, now we're going to ask you to carry them forward another year and not use them to offset your minimum tax payment. We, the administration, believe strongly, I believe the governor will agree, that people should pay the minimum tax. If there's a minimum tax, the minimum tax should actually be the number that's paid. And what we're attempting to do here is prevent situations where certain credits can be used to reduce payment below the minimum tax. If a multi-billion dollar company sits before us and says that that's going to fundamentally, consequentially harm their ongoing operations, I look forward to hearing that testimony. But we're talking about a relatively small number in the broader scope of this bill. We're talking about the 4% minimum.
Okay, I finally got to the answer I was looking for. Thank you.
Representative Josephson, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, this third bullet on page 23, is this the provision where a producer in the North Slope could, under current law, essentially pay no taxes, and in fact, the state would be, sort of inadvertently through the net operating loss credit, paying for the production without seeing any revenue except perhaps some royalty, or is this that provision?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, royalties, corporate income tax, property tax are not impacted by this bill and are not impacted by these credits in any way. Mm-hmm. What happens, we've modeled, if oil prices stay at a fixed price for a certain number of years, and what starts happening in the second and third year of lower prices is there's enough operating loss credits from the major producers that they're able to completely offset the minimum tax. Round numbers, and I've done this math in thin air before, at $50 oil, which is the price predicted in the fiscal year 16 for the revenue sources book. At $50 oil, there's about, that's $40 gross after transportation costs. There's about 160 million taxable barrels produced from the North Slope every year. That's about $6.5 billion worth of value. That's what the oil is worth at the wellhead, $6.5 billion. A 4% minimum tax is $250 million. In a pure minimum tax, that's the production tax revenue we would expect, $250 million. Currently this year we're expecting $150 million. The difference between those two is about $50 million is being offset by the small producer credit being used to reduce tax liability below the minimum tax, and another $50 million from operating loss credits from major producers. If low prices continue for a couple of years, that number will reduce to zero, and we would expect to get nothing from the production tax.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, there is another provision that deals with new oil, which I think may be the one that you were concerned about, that could actually drive the credits to something greater than the value of the loss.
Right, and just as far, that's where we get into a stacking phenomenon. Is that right? Or is that yet another circumstance?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that's another circumstance.
And through the chair, Representative Josephson, the stacking provisions are not so much relevant in the North Slope anymore because of the so-called spending-based credit. The capital expenditure credit has been repealed for Senate Bill 21, and the exploration credit is going to be sunsetting this summer. So it's unusual that the same project would be getting two credits for the same expenditure in the North Slope today.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to figure out, when we're talking about net operating loss, how we calculate that. I mean, we have one oil company that does do public reports, and they have their consolidated income statement, 8 pages long, and on the first page it says there's a loss, $67 million, but on the adjusted earnings, it's $482 million to the positive. So where do we get the net operating loss? Is that calculated after the adjustments for credits and all are made so that there's not a loss, or is it strictly on the first page number?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, let me try here. The Alaskan Production Tax Code is very much a cash flow-based tax. It's the entire sector, the North Slope as a whole, Cook Inlet as a whole, is commingled for tax purposes. How much did the company earn and how much did the company spend? And that includes not just operations of their current field, but say investment in a future field that might also be on the North Slope counts towards the tax calculation. We don't consider, say, depreciation, which is a factor of the federal tax code that impacts corporate income taxes but doesn't impact our production tax. I don't believe it includes other taxes. There's also a long list in current code in 4355-165E of all the ineligible deductions, lobbying expenditures, spill cleanup from lack of deferred maintenance. There are a lot of stuff that was added as part of the ACES bill in 2007 PPT. So it's a calculation of allowable expenses from actual revenue. That's the loss. And there aren't these adjustments that you'll see in the federal tax code, but the biggest and most obvious one being depreciation. The operating loss credit is a flat multiplier, a percentage of that number. And in calendar year 2015, that number on the North Slope was 45%. So if a company can show that they spent $100 million more than they earned, that's a $100 million operating loss, they would earn a $45 million operating loss credit. That, in the scenario I laid out a few minutes ago, could be used to reduce taxes below the minimum tax to the extent of that $45 million.
Representative Seaton.
And do any credits that they earn from the state of Alaska, other than net operating loss credit, do those count into that cash flow, or are those accounted for separately?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I don't feel confident to answer that question definitively, but I know we have Lenny Dees on the line who I bet will be able to give a more complete answer than I could to that question. Lenny, are you out there?
Hello, yes. This is Lenny Dees, Audit Master with the Department of Revenue Tax Division. Through the chair, Representative Seaton, no other credits are not counted in that particular loss calculation. The loss calculation, which is done by what we call segments, and for instance, the North Slope Oil and Gas production is a particular segment for a company, that loss calculation only takes into account the revenues from the oil and gas that's produced and sold by that particular company for that segment, less the annual lease expenditures for that particular segment. And the annual lease expenditures for that segment is comprised of the operating and capital expenditures. And to the extent that those lease expenditures exceed the revenues for that particular segment, you have a net operating loss for that segment.
So to follow up, we have a 35% credit against lease expenditures. So does that count into the revenue picture, or does that lower expenses before we calculate the loss?
Okay, so the 35%, that, through the chair, Representative Seaton, the 35% is the value of a deduction for a company, regardless of whether there is a loss or a profit for that particular segment. For instance, if you had a situation where a company has a positive production tax value, which is when the revenues exceed the lease expenditures, the impact of those lease expenditures on the taxes that is calculated for that company is for every dollar of lease expenditure they spend, they get a 35% deduction against the actual taxes that will be due for that particular segment. But in the event that you do not have a positive production tax value, i.e. a net operating loss, at that point the 35% is applied to the excess of the lease expenditures over the revenues to determine the credit for that particular segment.
If it would be helpful, we could actually slides that kind of walk through the calculations to show us. I think it's a lot easier to see it on paper than just to try and explain it. So.
Thank you. It would be helpful.
Okay. Thank you.
And for those of you watching at home, Mr. Chairman, the back couple of pages of the Revenue Sources book, which we published in December, has sort of a stylized, sort of simplified version of the production tax calculation in the aggregate for fiscal year 15, 16, and 17. You could see how we calculate barrels and then per barrel spending and how the different elements of the tax calculation work through. Mm-hmm. It's a complicated topic, needless to say. If I may, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to move on to slide number 24.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Representative Herron.
I just want to make a comment. Is I think the commissioner's come up with a great idea, and I looked at this presentation. Is that's why I brought up the Econ 1 analysis. It was in slides and graphs and modeling that's easy to see for these two smart gentlemen to explain it to it. It does help if we can look at pictures. Mm-hmm. So that's why I would recommend that the commissioner and to Ken is you expand upon that offer to show us in graphs and slides what you're trying to explain. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We would be happy to do so, Mr. Chairman. Whenever you want to bring us back, we will have that presentation ready. I know you have testimony calendared for the next couple of hearings, but whenever you'd like to bring the administration back, we would like to make that the focus of our next presentation.
Okay, thank you.
So the next example is the newer, smaller producer on the North Slope. These are the companies who are in production, who are operating fields but aren't the three major producers. For the most part, these are companies that have come to Alaska in the last 10 years or so. They are theoretically producing and theoretically... No, I'm on this one. Yeah. The, so at,
at higher oil prices, where the tax system, the underlying tax system of Senate Bill 21 remains in place, that company doesn't have any change. They have their production, they have their gross value reduction, they have their taxation, their $5 a barrel credit. For the most part, those new fields are eligible for the gross value reduction, for the new oil benefit from Senate Bill 21. What happens at below $85 a barrel is going to be material to these companies. Right now, the way the law is structured, the per barrel credit for new oil can reduce tax liability to zero, as opposed to for legacy oil, where that's where the minimum tax kicks in, where they're required to pay the 4% floor. We are looking to add the 4% minimum tax to so-called new oil, to gross value reduction eligible oil, and therefore the newer and smaller producers will be asked to pay a minimum tax on their production. Another impact on those companies is an example. It's one of the more technical provisions that I tried to describe to the committee in my previous presentation. If that company has a loss, an actual operating loss, right now the operating loss credit isn't tied to the loss. It ties to the loss as additionally subtracted from by the gross value reduction, thus creating a larger loss, a paper loss, and has led to circumstances where we've paid operating loss credits greater than 100% of the amount of the loss. That ability would be lost by those companies. Those companies would then, the operating loss credit would be limited to the size of the actual loss, and they wouldn't be able to take that adjustment to those losses. Mr. Chairman, slide number 25 is the new project developer on the North Slope. These are the entities who are not yet in production, who have a project, who have perhaps a discovery, and they're in the development phase of their operation. Those are the companies that earn their operating loss credits as a normal part of their business. And every year, we get applications, they prove up their expenditures, we write them a check. That's the annual cycle with folks that are in this stage of the process. And the 35% net operating loss credit continues to be earned. There is no change to that. What could change is the method by which those credits are paid back. And there's a little bit of a fork in the road at that. It depends on the nature of the company. If the company in question is a large multinational company, and that's defined in the bill as having annual revenues in excess of $10 billion, if they're larger than that, then they are no longer eligible to get cash for their credits. Those companies will have to hold on to their certificates until the future year when they are in production finally, have a tax liability, and can fully offset future tax liability against the lost credits that they had earned during the development stage.
Representative Hawker. Do these provisions just affect multinational companies operating in more than one country, or is a large domestic-only corporation exempt?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, I apologize if I used a term of art in what I perceive to be a term of art in the oil industry. No, if there is a large American company with $10 billion worth of annual revenue who doesn't operate in any other country, they would fall under that provision. The specific language in the bill says global revenues in the prior calendar year in excess of $10 billion.
And thank you. Very clear here. Thank you.
The alternative fork in the road, if a company doesn't meet that threshold, if they're a smaller company, then they are able to continue to get cash rebates for their tax credits. The limitation that we're imposing through this bill is to put a $25 million per company cap on the amount of state cash that they can get. Amounts in excess of that would have to be carried forward to a subsequent year. And it's possible that it would take multiple years to use up a credit depending on the size of the project. That number, $25 million, was not that's historic state statute. That was a limitation put in place with the PPT bill in 2006. Prior to 2006, there was no ability for state repurchase of credits. In 2006, we added the ability to do so with a specific cap at $25 million per company. Subsequently eliminated with the passage of the ACES bill in 2007.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On this point, are there, through the chair, Mr. Oppenheimer, companies that have sought more than $25 million, small companies, for new project development? And would this be if the answer is yes, would this be an example of what Representative Hawker was talking about, where there could be some observable slowdown of the incentive to develop the new project?
And
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, we have credits well in excess of $25 million to individual companies within a year, small companies as well. Once again, when the definition of small is less than $10 billion a year in annual revenue, that's different than the mom-and-pop grocery store down the street. And yes, we have spent well in excess of that per company. And it is reasonable to say that corporate decisions might be made differently if a limitation was put on that, if the state is no longer going to be spending more than $25 million per company per year.
Thank you.
The next slide, those are the three types of North Slope operator. We're now stepping into the Cook Inlet. The existing producer in Cook Inlet, that's the person who's producing oil or gas, selling the oil through the refinery, selling the gas through the local utilities or the LNG plant in Cook Inlet. What's their current situation? Well, currently they pay very low or in most cases zero taxes because of the Cook Inlet tax cap, which is not on the slide. Even in those cases where a company is required to pay the gas tax, the 17-cent per MCF gas tax, that is often offset nearly completely or completely by the small producer credit in Cook Inlet. So we've got very little, if any, tax revenue from Cook Inlet, yet those companies who are currently in production, not paying taxes, are eligible for the current credit repurchase through the capital and well use expenditure programs. You know, we were able to pay these companies for 20 to 40% of their capital and well spending, regardless of their profitability or whether or not they're paying taxes. As the bill is written, repeal of those credits means simply that the producer who doesn't have an operating loss is not earning refundable credits. They would continue to pay zero taxes, and the tax caps under current law remain in place through the end of 2021.
If I may, and I know you want to get through this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On this point, a member of the other body noted that the administration sort of applauded the effort in toto, but that the administration should reverse this proposition and tax the production while retaining the credits, that the net effect to Alaskans would be better doing that. Is that something the administration thought about?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, we haven't specifically modeled it. We did talk about it. Just to sort of put the numbers in perspective, the entire value, wellhead value, of all oil and gas production from the North Slope, from Cook Inlet, excuse me, last year was a little less than $1 billion, $800 or $900 million, I think. So I don't know offhand what the profitability of that is. I don't know what the production tax, what the net profits tax implication would be. This specific provision eliminating those spending credits is $150 or so million out of the fiscal note that we're talking about. So order of magnitude, possibly not quite. We are not necessarily opposed to talking about reintroducing the Cook Inlet tax or eliminating the Cook Inlet tax caps. It's not part of the bill before you. If we were to go there, simply repealing the cap language would likely be insufficient. The underlying tax regime in Cook Inlet is something of a hybrid of existing taxes and would require some modification. We would need to work on a specific proposal for a new Cook Inlet tax regime.
Thank you.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ken, this is another one. I mean, as recently as 5-6 years ago, the communities in relying upon the gas production, particularly out of the Cook Inlet, were having blackout drills, expecting to not have adequate gas to keep the heat and lights on in the middle of winter. We did pass legislation that specifically targeted and intended to promote exploration and development and to increase and provide energy security in South Central Alaska. Can you tell me and give me any kind of assurance that the consequences of implementing this bill as you're presenting it will not cause the industry to revert to the practices they had before we made those changes? And I say the practices. It's not like anybody intended. It was not economically, it just didn't work economically in the Cook Inlet. We made economic changes. The Cook Inlet Recovery Act recovered the inlet. Can you give me any assurance that this bill will not cause the inlet to revert to the status it was before and put my community back at risk of blackout drills and not having enough energy to keep the heat and lights on in the middle of the winter? Have you done that analysis? Can you give me an assurance and point to how you derived it?
Through the chair, Representative Hocker, for the record, Randy Hoffman, Commissioner of Revenue. The dynamics of Cook Inlet is dramatically different than it was 5 or 6 years ago when there was a market looking for gas and no gas behind the pipe to fill the pipe. The incentives that were put in place worked. There is now gas behind the pipe, and in fact there are several fields being developed or not being developed simply because they lack a market to spend the capital to finish the development. So can I say that 10 years from now we might not be back in that situation? No, I can't give anybody that assurance. But what I can say is that there is a period that we're in right now where that is not an issue, that there is additional gas that can be brought online in the near future when the market exists, and at some point in time, you know, not to be, you know, make it too cavalier, but, you know, can we declare victory and move on? You know, that maybe the particular set of credits that were in place for the time they were in place worked. We're at a stable point now, and that maybe sometime 3, 4, 5 years down the road, we might have to reintroduce credits if we see that we're starting to have a shortage on the horizon. But to continue to pay credits at a point in time where, quite frankly, the credits might be going to pay for an export project is at a time when the state's budget is tight, is something that we didn't see was the proper use of state resources.
Mr. Chair, this is disturbing because these are long lead time investments that are involved here. It's like turning an aircraft carrier. You know, you spin the wheel, the aircraft carrier doesn't turn on a dime. And I mean, that's kind of what we're dealing with these oil fields and the Cook Inlet. And again, I absolutely agree with you. I would love to declare victory and go home, but I'm only asking, show me some evidence that we can declare victory, something more than just, as we had the conversation at the last meeting, I was asked to trust you. And, you know, trust is a wonderful thing, but in economics here, I just don't know that I want to put my community at risk on faith. Today is the first day of Lent, but it's, a different kind of subject here.
Through the chair, Representative Hocker, we'll see what we can, work with DNR, what we can put together.
And could you also, when you do that, it's not just DNR, can we get my utilities here to give us assurance that they feel comfortable there will be adequate gas remaining behind their pipes for the foreseeable future?
Through the chair, I think that would be good testimony. I can't get them here.
We'll see what we can do. Representative Seaton.
And Mr. Chairman, as we're doing that analysis, I would really appreciate it if we put in the price of gas on this, because previously when we were putting in the going forward, we had gas priced at, if you produced it, you basically lost money. And since then, we have changed the structure with the RCA, so now it's the most profitable gas, I think, in the whole United States is produced here in Cook Inlet. So people will invest when they can make a profit. You've got to subsidize heavily if you have a regulation that means that whatever you sell at a loss. And I think that that's the situation we were in. And so I would like to see those coincident timings of not only when the credits came in, but also when the price went from $2.25 to $7 per MCF, meaning that it was profitable. And I think that at some point in time, we need to investigate this as a subsidy, because we are subsidizing these companies, these new developments. And if the only use for that gas is exporting, we have to very strenuously look at, is it the state's in the state's best interest to be subsidizing maybe losing the entire net value to the state, including the royalty value, corporate income tax, as well as any small amount of production tax for a company to export and make profit overseas. So I would like to have that basically graphically put into the analysis as well.
The chair, Representative Seaton, we'll put the numbers in. It's going to be very difficult to parse what was a credit effect versus a price effect. But
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To respond a little bit to what Representative Seaton said, we talked a little bit about some of those issues in the summer presentations in the Senate group. There was definitely a political dynamic in Cook Inlet. The RCA at the time was rejecting supply contracts that had higher prices tied to them. That led to the producers doing less work, and some of the supply shortages were due to not necessarily as much lack of gas as lack of work done to develop that gas. I mean, and that's a disputable concept, but those issues have largely been resolved not just through our tax credit system, but through the increase in the price of gas. Suddenly it is more economical to produce gas in the Cook Inlet. I said the number earlier, $800-900 million, the entire value of the annual production from Cook Inlet. I'll repeat a number from last week's presentation, just about $400 million in refunded tax credits is what the state of Alaska paid to Cook Inlet oil and gas explorers and developers. So a little bit less than half of the entire value of the entire resource was paid by the state through tax credits last year. When we skip on slide 27 to the impact on the new field developer in Cook Inlet, currently those individuals who are not operating, aren't selling resource yet, they receive the net operating loss credit. The net operating loss credit is 25% in the North Slope, but that is typically stacked. That's a word I've talked a little bit about and can go into greater detail, meaning it could be received alongside either the 20% capital or 40% well lease expenditure credit. Typically, an expenditure will be one or the other. The companies will try to get as much as possible into the 40% category, of course, and those expenses which might not qualify for the 40 will typically qualify for the 20. So it's something of a weighted average in the 30 to 35% range is typical. Stacked with the net operating loss, that means somewhere between 50 and 60% of the cost of a new field development is being directly subsidized by the state through the refundable tax credit program under current law, 50 to 60%. With the repeal of the Cook Inlet credits, the capital and well credits, the state would continue to support that activity but at a reduced level, at the 25% level, which is the Cook Inlet net operating loss. And to go back to something I said a moment ago when there was a conversation about reinstituting the tax, if that were to happen, that's one of the oddities out there. The Cook Inlet underlying tax is the 35% tax from Senate Bill 21, but the Cook Inlet net operating loss is the 25% from ACES. That's something of a hybrid system underlying us. So limited by that 25% operating loss credit, you get to the same fork in the road that I described for the North Slope. If it's a large company, national or multinational, $10 billion of annual revenue, they must hold their credits to be used against future tax liability. If it's a smaller company, they would be limited by that $25 million per company per year cap and would have to carry forward numbers in advance of that. Typically, the Cook Inlet projects are smaller in scale than the North Slope projects for obvious reasons, logistics and so on. So more of the companies operating in Cook Inlet are likely to fall into that $25 million cap situation, whereas some of the newcomers coming to the North Slope are more likely to fall into the $10 billion situation.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herron.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What about the companies that fall, they're not large and they're not smaller? Wouldn't that $25 million hurt them?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, if a company is investing $100 million a year, which is a good-sized company, in Cook Inlet right now, they would, at the end of the year, get a $50 or $60 million credit. If the bill passes and they did the exact same activity, they would be getting a $25 million credit. So it would hurt them to the extent they'd be getting $25 to $35 million less state dollars for their project. To the extent to which that makes that project feasible or more or less profitable is possible to say without looking at individual specific projects.
So, Mr. Chairman, returning to slide 25, why don't we just use that same question? Aren't there people now that are not large multinational, but they're definitely not smaller, and this new limitation would definitely hurt barrels going into the pipeline?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, if a company is earning more than $25 million a year in our annual loss credits, let's say you've got a mid-sized company, not a giant company, that's spending $400 million a year, just to pull a number out of thin air. They would be earning $100 million worth of, well, it's the North Slope, 35%. They would be earning, 35% of 400 is $140 million in, that's not right, $127 million in operating loss credits. If, in fact, they could only cash in $25 million per year, it means the rest of them would roll forward into the next year and then the next year. If they keep investing $400 million a year, if this becomes a multi-billion dollar project, yeah, there would be a big stack up of deferred credits that might that might become a large future liability for the state, or it might, in some, those credits start to sunset after 10 years. The reality of it is, though, if you look at a large North Slope development, like let's say someone comes up and wants to spend $2.5 billion on a major project on the North Slope under current law, it's going to take 10 years. As great as that is for barrels in the pipeline and jobs and on economic development and everything else, $2.5 billion at 35% is $875 million. That's the amount of money we would be writing in checks to that company in advance of the first dollar that we received in production taxes, corporate income taxes, or anything else, maybe a little bit of property tax. So the intent of this bill is to simply constrain the state's cash flow to what is a feasible number given our fiscal realities.
Representative Hawker.
Thank you. We've opened up the multinational line of questioning again. That's where I was going to wait a slide, but it's a great time to ask the question. I guess we've had so much discussion over the years at these tables, here in this building, on the other side of the building, about how important it was in our tax structure to level the playing field, give every company equal access and ability to do work in the state of Alaska. But here, this is very clearly defining a prejudice and a discrimination against bigger companies. And that might be a good thing, I don't know. But I'm just wondering why, if it's good to discriminate against those big companies and we want them to basically have to use their credits only against their own future tax liability, we don't cash them out, we've got a cash flow problem, I agree. I really ask, why wouldn't we want to make that apply to everybody? Why wouldn't we want to make all companies working here, and we say, look, equal footing for everybody. You use the credits we offer you against your own future earnings and against no one else's. And to throw another little twist at this is, what if you got a big multinational company, pick a name, XYZ Super Company. They operate almost exclusively in Southwest Africa, but they're interested in kind of doing a little work in Alaska, so they invest a small amount of capital to really try to do a small project in Alaska. Why would we want to discriminate against that investment? Throwing discrimination inherent, statutory intentional discrimination into our tax code seems problematic. So I guess why wouldn't we just have everybody use the certificates against their future liability and basically save the state the cash you're concerned about?
Mr. Chairman, I want to disagree with one thing that Representative Hawker just said, and that is that there's some inherent discrimination in this. There's existing discrimination in current law, if you want to call it that, that says if a company produces more than 50,000 barrels per day in Alaska, they're not eligible to get cash for their tax credits. Those companies have to hold those certificates and carry them forward. That was written to apply to basically three companies, the major North Slope producers. The expectation was those companies would have relatively large tax liabilities and would offset their credits against their liability. But if they don't, which is the circumstance we're in right now, they're forced to carry them forward. But part of the rationale there, I believe, is that these are, by their nature, large companies with balance sheets and bank accounts and diversified investment portfolios, that they could afford better than a smaller company to hold a tax credit certificate on their balance sheet and get the value for it later rather than coming to the state for cash. What we realized in discussing possible future liability, and some of this conversation started when we were before this committee talking about ANWR during the previous session, is the large companies who don't operate in Alaska are in many ways very similar to the large companies that do operate in Alaska. They're global, diversified, have bank balances, balance sheets, and we don't need necessarily to be writing checks to those companies. They can hold those credits on their balance sheets. It's the smaller company, especially the company that might be a forming itself for the purpose of, and I'll ask, an investment that's going to have the more imminent cash flow need. And that's why if we were going to protect to a limited extent state cash for credits, we wanted to limit it to those who most likely were going to be in need of that cash in the short term. So we created a line that said, if you aren't in this large company category, then you can get the cash. But if you are, you can wait. That was the decision we made, and we chose a number. I don't believe that number is carved in stone, but the theory behind it, I believe, is sound.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And was this also to address the issue of a not well, a company that's not well resourced and then goes out of business, and you know, basically, we've given them this opportunity to make investments and, you know, have credits that would cover that until such time that they have a tax liability, but if they go bankrupt before the time they have a tax liability, then we're left having just given the credits.
Certainly. Through the chair, Representative Tarr, the state of Alaska doesn't want anyone to go bankrupt to save us tax credit money. That would be an unfortunate reality. Bankruptcies are awkward for all concerned, and we're facing some of them in the industry right now. Smaller ones, thankfully. To a certain extent, if the benefit package gets too generous, if we're paying too large a percentage of things, it is possible that certain inefficient decisions might be made, that more speculative or less likely to for success projects might be funded with the expectation that, well, the risk to us is much smaller because the state's going to pay close to two-thirds of our money. We could take that loss. So it is reasonable to say that perhaps the projects that do go forward are the ones that have better fundamentals and are more likely to result in success.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, just to expand a little bit, this doesn't do anything directly to protect the state from having to pay the credits if a company goes bankrupt. Mm-hmm. If they've earned the credits become an asset of the who's ever doing the bankruptcy proceedings, and so we can't stop from paying them if they've earned them.
Thank you.
So, Representative Seaton, Representative Justice.
Thank you. Before I go on to it, I would just like to notice that the bankruptcy issue is an issue, and it's been a real issue for Alaska suppliers that, we had a Buccaneer went bankrupt, and all of a sudden you had fuel suppliers that sold them fuel, got paid for the fuel, they burned up the fuel, and then the bankruptcy court comes back and says, oh, you got paid within 90 days of when they decided to declare for bankruptcy, so you have to return to the bankruptcy court the money that paid for the fuel that they burnt. And it's the same thing with the services provided in the Homer Harbor, where you had the dockage and that was had to be refunded, and water supply companies. So just putting a little note out here, I do have an amendment to bring forward later when we get to amendments on the bankruptcy issue. But Mr. Chairman, one thing that I think that we should consider on these high amounts of credits is that we predicated this on the idea that it's really expensive to do things. It's much more expensive to do projects in Alaska than any place else in the United States. So we had to have these credits to lower the cost of the project going forward, and therefore we would get a competitive final investment decision because it kind of equalized costs. But we had this summer Hillcorp come up, in Kenai at the hearing there, and they testified that they have worked out procedures so they've lowered their costs to the same as they have in the lower 48, and they also testified that they were moving that on the North Slope and that they anticipated having equivalent costs on their activities up there. So at some point in time, we have to look at these credits and how much we're giving, and are we promoting inefficiencies in companies? And so I don't think that we should be, subsidizing inefficiencies. So I guess at some point I'd like to see that addressed into the aspect of how we're doing with how much costs we are offsetting or subsidizing, and how much is really necessary with some of the technical and new company innovations that are coming. I'll wait.
You wait?
Yeah.
Okay. If I could just make one comment. I know you had said that that number maybe has some flexibility to it. I'm probably a simpler guy than most of the people in the room, but I was a private businessman, and sometimes I wonder when we attach those numbers if we haven't actually really sat down and studied particular percentages. We've talked about companies. A small company can be a $50 million investment. It could be a $400 million investment, or upwards of $2 billion if they're not going to bring in $10 billion. Well, you know, the time value to the money you've invested is just critical to you continuing forward, more so than an attached number. I hope that we would at least consider at some point in time more of a percentage basis rather than it's hard when you've got that big a gap to define that. In a, that's just my opinion, and but I do appreciate you saying that's a number, you know, maybe there's a discussion about how we move that number. But like I say, just from a simple businessman's perspective, the time value of money when you're making an investment and the ability to continue on, I think, is something that we all need to kind of think about as we do that. So Mr. Alper, we'll try and keep moving along because you're doing well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the kind words. The time value of money is substantial. It's material, and we're talking about asking people to defer receiving cash for us for potentially a number of years. The corollary to that is the alternative, the status quo, is to continue to spend $500 million a year towards a program in an environment where the state's annual general fund revenue is less than $2 billion, down two-thirds or so from what it was just a couple of years ago. So all of these factors are what's before the legislature to weigh, and as you look at this bill and other legislation moving forward. The last of these example scenarios is the interior or frontier area explorer. I'm limiting it to explorer because there is no real production yet in the interior parts of the state or the frontier areas. Currently, the explorer is receiving the 65% state credit for exploration and 50 to 60% for development. What does that mean? That's really a stack of things. The exploration incentive credit is about 40%, and then you have the operating loss credit at 25%. They're eligible for both. Once they're past the exploration phase and it becomes more of a development activity, you've got that weighted average of the well and the capital expenditure I referred to earlier, 30, 35% stacked with the 25% loss credit for the 50 to 60%. Now, the capital and well credits are going away. So under the development phase, projects in the frontier areas would only be receiving the 25% net operating loss credit. That's comparable to what the change was in Cook Inlet that I described a few minutes ago. However, the exploration credits have been extended through 2022. That was a provision inserted into the exploration statutes as an amendment to Senate Bill 21. So in the frontier areas of the state where we're trying to get new production found and brought on board, those companies, and a lot of them are native corporations, those companies, their qualified expenditures will get paid by the state at the 65% rate for at least another 5 or 6 years while they prove up their exploration.
Could I ask
Representative Josephson?
So under Senate Bill 20, thank you, through the chair, under Senate Bill 21, Mr. Alper, we told, for example, folks in the Nanana Basin that we would pay 65 cents on the dollar of their good efforts. And although it's ongoing, and I've been to their presentations at the RDC conference, and I think they're earnest and honest about their prospects, there hasn't been any production at all. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that's correct, although the gentleman from Dorian presented a couple of times to Senator Geisel's working group. It sounds like they are in something approaching active development. They're quite bullish on something that they found, and they hope to bring some production online. And they did some modeling to show that even as we support it with credits at this level, well, even though the taxes are quite low, capped through other statute in the interior, the state will receive royalties that would more than offset our investment. You know, the caveat to that that's important for the committee to remember as we get to the frontier areas of the state, the prevalence of state land is not as widespread there. The central north slope is state land. Large areas of Cook Inlet where the oil and gas development's been is state land, which means we receive the royalty. If someone were to develop a major project on privately held, on corporation-held land, even if that project would be eligible for hundreds of millions of dollars in credit, there might not be any material amounts of revenue coming in simply because we don't get the royalty. Someone else does. So, if I may, now we're past the examples and into the sum totals. What does all this add up to? Now, this is something of a rough estimate, but it's the best we can come up with a lot of moving parts. We believe this bill in the FY17 budget is worth about $500 million. Now, that's three or four different things. Of that $500 million, we've identified approximately $200 million in credit certificates that would not be issued. Things that currently result in credits being issued that are no longer going to exist. Primarily the repeal of the, I say 023 AML, I apologize for the technical language, that's the capital expenditure and the well lease expenditure in the non-North Slope areas. Those are worth roughly $150 million, I said that number earlier, and then the elimination of the so-called loopholes, the ability to increase the size of an operating loss and a few other minor provisions is the remaining $25 to $50 million worth of credits no longer earned. The set of 200 million credits that's the part where we can be legitimately accused of kicking the can down the road. There's $200 million worth of certificates that are going to be earned, that are going to be held, that are simply not going to be cashable this year, that they're going to be used against some future year's tax liability in a year where hopefully we have more tax revenue. These are the entities that fall under the repayment cap, the $25 million, or the large company cap, the $10 billion. People will be holding credits and can't cash them in for one reason or another, and will use them in some future year. And as I say, based on the new repurchase limits. That gets us to $400 million. The last bunch, $100 million, is additional revenue. If you were to break out that $100 million, about $50 million of it comes from raising the floor from 4% to 5%. I said that earlier. About another $50 million comes from hardening the floor, preventing certain credits from being able to be used to reduce payments below the minimum tax. There's also a little bit of additional money, probably less than $25 million, that would come from the increase in interest rate. That number would increase a little bit over time. But because we're talking, for the most part, about tax assessments, delinquent taxes, that's not general fund money. That's money that would find its way into the Constitutional Budget Reserve once it was eventually paid.
Representative Joseph. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Alpert, if I was talking to a constituent about this, and they said, what will be the historic cut under this proposal? It would be more accurate for me to say $300 million than $500 million, because the other $200 million we will pay if there is a future tax liability, and that's a huge contingency. Am I right about that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that's a legitimate point to make. Yes, the net effect would be about $300 million. The immediate effect, when we're talking about balancing the budget that's before the legislature this session, is $500 million, meaning the impact on the FY17 budget.
Representative Hawker. Macro question. As you said, you can't really drill down micro, but macro. These changes made in the FY17 budget, you know what the total government take will be on industry as a percent rate of expected revenues based on our currently projected low revenue scenario, low oil price scenario?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, we have not remodeled total government take, including tax credits, in the current low price scenario. We've got a bit of an unusual circumstance now because the minimum tax does lead to some very high government take calculations. If you have a company that's losing money and paying a minimum tax, that creates an infinite government take on the production tax. However, the tax credits are something of an offset to that haven't previously been built into our government take calculations. So we would like to get that back to you. I'm very curious. The change in government take both on the tax side and on the credit side, it's only fair, however, to look at in the aggregate. And I think the conversation on government take is a little bit misleading when we don't include tax credits in the conversation. And what one thing that was happening during the hearings on Senate Bill 21 was that we weren't discussing tax credits when we were discussing government take. The baseline number, the consensus number, if you will, on Senate Bill 21 was an expectation of total government take in the
65 to 68% range across a wide range of prices. We're kind of outside the expected wide range of prices, and I don't know to what extent those numbers have moved given current reality, and I'd like to find out.
But I did hear you say the intent of this bill is to take an industry that today is actually losing money and impose an infinite increase in taxes on them by basically saying you're losing money, but we're going to raise your taxes.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, these are large companies that operate over multi-year cycles. Their business model, as I understand it, expects highs and lows. We are very much in a low swing right now. So a small increase in the minimum tax would increase their down at this moment of the cycle. That could be said without hesitation.
So the short answer is yes. You intend to increase taxes on companies already losing money in the state of Alaska.
Through the chair, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Ken, you recently completed the 2008 ACES production tax credit. I think that was the second one, but you've got seven more to go that are overdue. You've cut back one of your master tax auditors, I believe, and didn't look for any additional people for oil and gas audits. How on earth are you going to get the stuff done on this if you're 7 years behind on what you have in front of you already?
Through the chair, Representative Olson, I don't like to think of it as being behind. We are on target. We haven't missed any deadlines. We have a statute of limitations that we're closer to than I'm comfortable with, but we have zero intent of missing any deadlines, and everything will be done before the deadline, and we are on an active program to speed up somewhat. The audit master, I'm not sure exactly what Representative Olson's audit master question is about. There was one audit master position that was cut in the current year's budget last session. That position was held by a person who was promoted and became our deputy commissioner, and we chose not to refill the position. There is an audit master position being eliminated in the current budget, but that person has really not been working on production tax issues, frankly. That person has been functioning more of an economic research role. The core audit staff that does the day-to-day work of reviewing the information from companies, being in communication with the companies, doing all the calculations and making sure that the numbers add up, those people, that's a solid core group of our workforce that we are not looking to cut.
Follow up.
Representative Olson.
Well, again, I probably didn't make myself completely clear. The 2008 audit generated $285 million.
Through the chair, $265 million in assessments. And to be clear there, Mr. Chairman, not all of that was paid. Some of that is under dispute right now and has not been paid. We're going through the appeals process with one or more of those producers.
But it'd be safe to assume that we have a lot of money that's hanging out on the other seven audits.
Through the chair, Representative Olson, just as we, the Department of Revenue, have gone through something of a learning curve in what's legal and what's not in the world of a net profits tax, I believe the companies are doing the same. My expectation is over time the audits go cleaner and faster as all of the bugs get worked out and all of the rules and procedures get worked out. Once we've rejected something a couple of times, they're going to stop claiming it again. So I'm not exactly sure how much money there is out there on the table, although I, without question, look forward to it. I will be able to, well before the end of this session, talk about the 2009 audit completions. Once they're done, I will happily come before this or any other committee and talk about the numbers, as well as our strategy for accelerating our audit process and getting caught up on these audits.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that point, this has been the history oil and royalty debate since 1977, hasn't it? I mean, there was the ARCO tax period in the 80s that wasn't resolved until the 90s. That was several hundred million dollars. There was Amarillo Hess. That was over $1 billion. I mean, I want you to stay on target and not miss deadlines, but there's nothing about that that is unusual. Historically in Alaska.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, it's a litigious industry, and it's a vague, there's a lot of vague transactions that are prone to differences in interpretation. I think it's a complicated topic. The specific cases you referred to in the past were more multi-year lawsuits that resulted in large back payments. But both those payments, you mentioned Amarada Hess, as well as the current tax assessments, if we say XYZ company owes us $30 million for short paying their taxes last year, or 4 or 5 years ago, that's not general fund money. That does not balance the budget. The entirety of that money goes to the constitutional budget reserve, caveat. If the money in question results from a royalty shortfall, which a lot of the older lawsuits did, the appropriate percentage goes to the permanent fund, and then the remaining goes to the constitutional budget reserve. So however much money might be hanging out there, and I don't want to hope for a couple billion dollars because that means people were abusive in their tax filings. I want to hope that the number is zero and that everything is buttoned down just right. But if there is a large amount of money that comes to the state, it's not going to have any immediate impact on the budget deficit.
Representative Olson.
Point here.
Isn't it to the advantage of the state to have it take 7 years? Because aren't you making 11.5% or 12% interest?
Through the chair, Representative Olson, the interest rate through January 1st, 2014 was 11%. With the effective date of Senate Bill 21, the interest rate, including on old things, reset to the statutory rate, which is 3% over the federal discount rate. It moves every quarter. The current quarter, it's 4%. So, I don't want to conjecture or speculate on industry behavior, but when it was 11% and we assessed the tax, they tended to pay it and then go through the protest process, because if they got paid back, they got paid back with interest. Now it's more in their interest to not pay the assessment and protest, because the additional cost of more time is only 4%.
Representative Olson. Follow up.
On the 2008 audit, wasn't almost two-thirds of it interest?
Through the chair, Representative Olson, no, about $150 million was tax and about $115 million was interest, roughly 40%.
And last question, does the interest go to the CBR?
Through the chair, yes. The entirety of the payment goes to the CBR, and we have a process for that. And the CBR is also used to pay refunds if there is an assessment and then an appeals process, and then they win or a settlement is made somewhere in the middle. We actually pull small amounts of money out of the CBR to pay reverse tax assessments as well.
Yes. Representative Hocker.
Thank you. Mr. Alper, you just made a statement that the oil and gas industry, that the oil and gas industry in the state of Alaska was, in your words, litigious. I do a quick Google search on the definition of the word litigious, and the first definition that comes up is unreasonably prone to go to law to settle disputes. Do you believe it is unreasonable for the oil and gas industry in the state of Alaska to have legitimate challenges with assessments of taxes?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, I was not specifically limiting my comment to Alaska. The industry engages in very large transactions in very diverse areas all over the world. And many, oftentimes there's disputes over valuation. I don't want to question your dictionary definition or the reasonableness of anything. Everyone has the rights to the legal process, whether the simplest citizen of the largest company or the state of Alaska itself. That's why the legal process exists.
And you believe that that particular industry is unreasonably prone to go to law to resolve those disputes?
Through the chair, no, I do not believe that anyone is being unreasonable.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson. And yeah. I want to let the committee know we've got 20 minutes left in 5 pages.
Right.
So I would like to get to the sectional analysis and let Mr. Alper get to that point. So I'll just let you know ahead of time.
Just on that point, what I heard was it's a litigious business. I think he was referring to both sides, but maybe I misheard him.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to Representative Josephson for clarifying. So our fiscal note is a little bit unusual. We are able to highlight $500 million in the immediate year, but our forecast of future tax credit expense tends to decline as you go into the out years. And that's not necessarily tied to actual expectation of less credits being spent. It's actually tied to our production forecast. We can only forecast oil production if we know the project has been sanctioned and is going to happen. We tend to add projects as we get closer to the present. You know, we're looking at things 3 and 4 years from now. We don't know what wells are going to be drilled. Likewise, we don't know what credits are going to be earned. So there's a natural tendency for estimate of tax credit spending to increase as you get closer to the present. So when you look at the fiscal note before you, Mr. Chairman, and other members of the committee, you will see smaller numbers as far as the savings of expenditure. Those numbers are pegged to our official forecast of tax credit spend, which is in the revenue sources book, reduced by $50 million. We're essentially saying that we expect to reduce our credit spend to $50 million, $50 to $100 million per year in future years from whatever the number would be as we get closer to the present. When we say our forecast only includes known projects. And we have a very conservative forecasting methodology, and it's not for this committee and this hearing, but we could discuss the evolution of our forecasting methodology. It's actually gotten much more conservative in recent years. Most new projects, anything that folks might talk about and come before this committee when you speak to industry and say, we want to do A, B, or C, those are projects that haven't been sanctioned yet, are not yet in our credit forecast, and if they were to actually happen, would increase the expected spend given current law. Looking at the transition, most of the changes in the bill have an effective date of July 1st of this year, meaning up until that point, current law remains in place. We used the term in the larger themes section earlier in the presentation of saying honoring existing credits. What does honoring existing credits mean? Well, Representative Hawker mentioned the $200 million veto. The commissioner mentioned it as well. We do expect $700 million in tax credits are going to be claimed this fiscal year, but only $500 are going to be paid. That's the limitation of the appropriation. So there's going to be $200 million hanging past at the end of fiscal year 16. We're estimating $425 million in credits that would, under normal circumstances, be paid next year. These are almost entirely credits earned in the past calendar year. The company spent the money, they did the projects, they're going to file their taxes in March and claim all of these credits. And then we have whatever would be earned in the first half of the present calendar year before the effective date of the bill. That gets us to a number somewhere past $800 million, leaving a little bit of room for unanticipated circumstances. Rounding up, frankly, we said we want to put $1 billion in the tax credit fund to make sure that there is adequate funds to clear the deck of whatever credits might be earned prior to the effective date. If you look at the fiscal note, it's a little bit unusual. The operating budget has $74.3 million in it. That's a number that comes out of a statutory formula. So the fiscal note is adding $926.6 million, which is the difference between that number and $1 billion. So that's how we get to the billion in the so-called transition fund. It would actually be an appropriation out of the Constitutional Budget Reserve and into the Oil and Gas Tax Credit Fund.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herron.
Thank you. Ken, the governor has said that all these tax proposals are mostly written in pencil because the legislature is going to weigh in on it. When you're going through this, could you tell us where there's places where it's written in pen that's must have? Could you do that for us?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I think the governor says it's all written in pencil. The intent, the goal, is to reduce the amount of money that the state spends every year from the current multiple hundreds of millions of dollars to a more manageable number in line with our available resources. I have complete faith in the ability of the committee and the rest of the legislature to come up with a solution that does not need to be exactly what we're proposing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So what's it going to cost to implement this? Inevitably, there's a fiscal note. This is a little bit larger than the fiscal notes you'll see on some of the other smaller revenue bills. There's a lot of reprogramming involved in this. It's a very complicated tax system. It works very well to do the work, but it's a little bit hard-coded. So when you make a change, it requires bringing back the programmers to recode things. So we're changing the way balances are handled, which credits exist, how different transactions get posted. We do not have a number. We have requested of our contractor, the company that built the system for us, to come up with an estimate of implementing the bill the way we wrote it. We have not yet received that. The number $1.5 million is frankly a placeholder. We expect the number will be different, and we expect that it will be lower. Once we get a real number from the contractor, we will come before this committee or whatever committee the bill is in front of at that moment to adjust that number to what we expect it will cost to accomplish it. These are one-time funds. This would be, in effect, a capital appropriation or a supplemental appropriation to say, here's some money to do this thing once. We will not need additional resources, additional staff to to implement and manage the ongoing tax program once the changes are made. So these slides are standard for all of the revenue bills we have before us. I'll let Commissioner Hoffbeck talk about how this bill fits into the broader picture.
Chairman Tallarico, we talked about this a little bit during the introduction to the presentation. The next two slides just kind of line out the new Sustainable Alaska Plan and where these various components fit into the totality of the plan. There's really three parts to it. One is using investment earnings that gets us and existing taxes. It gets us about $4.3 billion. We're trying to get to about a $5.2 billion target. This particular bill actually hits in the other two places. It hits in spending reductions at a rate of $400 million for the upcoming fiscal year. So it's actually not paying the credits is a reduction in our expenditures. And then it fits in also in the new revenue component at $100 million, and that's the hardening of the cap and the increasing of the rate from 4% to 5%. So it hits in two of the three components of the new Sustainable Alaska Plan.
Mr. Chairman, do we...
Representative Hawker?
Yeah, you have to apologize, Mr. Chairman. I need to go back half a step if I could here. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a technical question, but the billion-dollar capitalization you want to put into the oil and gas tax credit fund, again, I do have the right fiscal note in front of me today. You do show that as an FY 2017 appropriation already requested. And the note at the bottom indicates that the initial version showing funding, da da da, and this will be reflected in the governor's amended appropriation bill. Where is that $1 billion in the appropriation process? Is it in the supplemental appropriation bill?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, I don't have the document in front of me at this moment. I don't recall if it's going to be in the governor's supplemental bill. I wrote some of that text, and I'm not recalling the specific sentence you're referring to, so I want to look back at it. My expectation is that it's a fiscal note that's attached to the bill, so it would be contingent on the passage of a version of the bill. That's usually how these things are structured, but I honestly don't have a off-the-cuff answer to that question and I haven't seen the governor's supplemental bill, the governor's amended appropriation bill, to know if that's in there.
Okay, well, then, Mr. Chair, I agree. The way the appropriation is, the fiscal note's presented, you are requesting in the fiscal note the billion-dollar fund cap, but I was just confused by the statement at the bottom of your note there that this will be reflected in the governor's amended appropriation bill. So,
through the chair, Representative Hawker, we'll clear that up.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. May I proceed with the sectional analysis?
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to make sure it was on the record for them to bring back, I'm really interested in the gross value reduction on North Slope or wherever it exists, and what that does for a net present value calculation for our investment. If we're investing in a new field, what's the expected investment over time? What is the, at our CBR or our permanent fund discount rate, and what is the net present value, both offsetting production tax and offsetting all revenues that the general fund would receive. So I'd like to get that presentation so that when we're looking at considering these tax credit investments, we'll know whether we are going to anticipating at what price lose money over the totality of the project, or where we're going to make money over the totality of the project. So just a request when they come back for presentation.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we envision some sort of scenario drill down within the more math-oriented presentation we expect to bring before the committee next.
And, Mr. Alper, I appreciate you being here today. There's no possible way to get from this front to the back of the sectional analysis today.
No, so, of course not. If you like, given that we have 10 minutes, I can sort of blow through the easy parts and point out the three or four sections that are the
for those among the committee members who like to drill down and analyze deep statute, the sections that are sort of the most essential to the core changes we're making in the bill.
If you can summarize some of those points, I think that would be great for us.
Sure, absolutely. On this first slide, I'm going to skip right past conforming language. We are changing the interest rate. The way that's described in the bill is in Section 7 of the bill. We are simply increasing from a number tied to 3% above the federal discount rate to 7% above the federal discount rate. That in kind of splits the difference between the historic pre-2014 interest rate and what was put in place through the passage of Senate Bill 21. We haven't discussed it much, but there's the confidentiality waiver, the ability to talk about specific spend by individual companies. That's in Section 8 of the bill. It turns certain information that's currently considered taxpayer proprietary and makes it public information. Section 17 is in one of the mother sections of the bill, for lack of a better word. That describes the minimum tax and how it's calculated. It defines the credits that if the bill passes, will no longer be able to reduce payment below the 4% level. And it also, and when I was going through the specific changes, I talked about this, the ability to move the per taxable barrel credit around from month to month and instead turning that into more of a truly monthly calculation so as to protect the state from the need for a large tax rebates, end of year refunds at the end of a year that has a lot of volatility, calendar year 2014 being a prime example. So that Section 18 imposes the minimum tax on the gross value reduction eligible oil and the new oil. That's something that doesn't currently exist. New oil can pay as low as zero. Section 20 adds the 10-year sunset on credit certificates. That, because we're going to be deferring a lot of payment, that 10-year thing is material and something that should be discussed. Section 22 relates to DNR's needs that I referred to earlier, making sure that as the exploration credits expire, that they will be able to receive seismic data, downhill data, well logs for their own planning and strategic purposes tied to other credits rather than to the exploration credits. We have Section 26 is the sections that talk about who is suddenly no longer eligible to receive cash for their tax credits. The $10 billion limit, the $25 million per year limit, all those are in the various sections of 26, of subsections of Section 26, which in the current law, what we're amending, 028E, are other restrictions on who can get cash, specifically the 50,000 barrel a day, the large current producer exemption is in there, and we're building on top of it. Section 27 is the Alaska higher restriction on credit rebate that I referred to in that first presentation. Let's see what else is important enough to bring up. I talked about the municipal problem where a municipal utility, if they sell a small amount of production, they're eligible for sometimes very large credits because of the way that law is currently interpreted. Section 37 cleans that up. Most of the rest of it is conforming. The definition of outstanding liability to the state, that's Section 39. Right now, if a company owes taxes, they can't get their credit. We pay their taxes out of the credit first. We're broadening that we could also pay other liabilities to the state, royalties and the like. So in doing so, we needed a definition of outstanding liability to the state. So that was added in what's Section 39. Section 44 is a retroactive effective date just applying to Section 17. That's the floor hardening section. Because of the specific situation with major producers using operating loss credits to reduce their minimum tax payments, we want that to take effect this year so that we can recapture some of that money that we're going to begin losing at the end of January. The rest of it's pretty straightforward. The ability to write regulations, immediate effective date for transition language, and of course an effective date of July 1st for the rest of the bill. I thank you for the opportunity, over too long and somewhat fun and somewhat grueling presentations to discuss this important piece of legislation with your committee.
Thank you, and we look forward to, we will have you back at some point in time. We can do some more of the sectional analysis. I believe you were going to bring us back a new slide presentation with a a promised simpler version of explaining these taxes, so that'll be very interesting to see those slides. We look forward to that. Just one question that I'd like to ask you. There is a lot of confusion with those people that are actually working in the Frontier Basin, and your presentation clearly says that they're still eligible for the 65% tax credits up until 2022, I believe you said. I have been approached by several of those operators and have said that those expire on them this 1st of July. So I just want to be assured that when I do tell them that, no, those are extended to 2021 or 22, that that is the case.
Mr. Chairman, let me be even more explicit in this one, because we're talking in some ways about two different things. There was a Frontier Basin credit, a specialized credit that was modeled in many ways on the Cook Inlet jackup rig credit. That passed as part of a Frontier incentive bill during the 2012 session. That credit, which is 80% of certain expenditures with certain limit to the first well, that kind of thing, in the four basins, six basins, that is expiring on July 1st. However, the underlying exploration incentive credit, that was a statewide credit of 40%, has been specifically extended for the Frontier Basins through 2022. So whereas the 80% credit, which has never been claimed or used, by the way, but if the Frontier Basin specific credit is going away, those explorers in the Frontier Basins will be able to get the exploration credit stacked with an operating loss credit with a total state contribution of 65%.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I appreciate that. Anything else from the committee? Any further comments, questions?
Just on that point, real fast.
Representative Joseph,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the bill, which I'm still studying, actually extends some credits that otherwise, or replaces them. I mean, is there a feature that is actually arguably generous to the industry in that respect?
Through the chair, Representative Joseph, I don't want to answer that question broadly because it's open-ended, but no, the bill is not extending any credits. We have credits that have existing sunsets established in current law of July 1st, 2016, the bulk of the exploration credits, the Frontier Basin credits, the jackup rig credit. We have the small producer credit that begins a slow sunset in May of this year. Under a previous legislation, an amendment made on the House floor, a late amendment to Senate Bill 21, the exploration credits in the areas outside the North Slope and Cook Inlet were specifically extended to January 1st, 2022. And we are simply maintaining that with this legislation.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else from committee members? Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. We appreciate you being here today, and we will be in touch to have you back at some time in the near future.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And with that, we will adjourn at 3 p.m.